Chapter 70. I had taken off my makeup and curled up to watch the late news when Edmund's call came. Claire's husband was frantic, stammering. The impossibility of what he was struggling to describe slammed into me with the force of a train. She'll be all right, Lindsay. She's at Peninsula Hospital now. I yanked a fleece pullover over my head, tugged on some jeans, and throwing a top hat on the roof of the car, raced down to Burlingame. I made the 40-minute drive in under 20 minutes. I found Claire still in one of the treatment rooms, sitting upright, dressed in the same rust-colored suit I had left her in only 3 hours before. A doctor was applying a bandage to her neck. Edmund and Willie were by her side. "Jesus, Claire," was all I could manage, my eyes hot and moist. I melted into Edmund, resting my head on his shoulder, and gave him my warmest, most grateful hug. Then I threw my arms all over Claire. "Go easy on the TLC, honey," she winced, jerking her neck. Then she managed a smile. "I always told you one day these fat cells would come in handy. Takes a hell of a shot to reach anything vital in me." I was still squeezing her. "Do you have any idea how lucky you are?" "Yeah," she exhaled. I could see it in her eyes. "Believe me, I know." The bullet had only grazed her. The ER doctor had cleaned the wound, bandaged it, and was releasing her without even keeping her overnight. Another inch, and we wouldn't have been talking now. Claire reached out for Edmund's and Willie's hands and smiled. "My men did okay, didn't they? Both of them. Edmund's car scared the sniper away." Edmund grimaced. "I should have chased that bastard myself if I'd caught him." "Down, Tiger," Claire smiled. "Let Lindsay be the heat. You stay a drummer. I always told you," she said, squeezing his hand. "Rachmaninoff might be in his head, but when it comes to his heart, the man's all doggy dog." Almost at once, the reality of what had almost happened seemed to overwhelm him. Edmund's bravado melted away. He sat down, just leaned against Claire for a while, and as he tried to speak, put a hand over his eyes. Claire held his hand without speaking. A little more than an hour later, after going through the story with the Burlingame police, we walked the grounds outside her house. "It was him, wasn't it, Claire? It was Chimera." She nodded her head. "Yes." "He's a real son of a bitch, Lindsay. I heard him say, 'Lean a little to the left, Doc.' Then he started firing." Local cops and the San Mateo County Sheriff's Office were still scrambling all over the house and yard. I had already called Clapper to come down and lend a hand. Claire said, "Why me, Lindsay?" "I don't know, Claire. You're black. You work in law enforcement. I don't understand it myself. Why would he change his pattern?" "We're talking calm and deliberate, Lindsay. It was like he was toying with me. He made it sound personal." I thought I saw something I had never seen in her before. Fear. Who could blame her? "Maybe you should take some time off, Claire," I told her. "Stay out of sight." "You think I'm going to let him push me under a rock? That's not a possibility, Lindsay. No way I let him win." I gave her a gentle hug. "You're okay?" "I'm okay. He had his chance. Now I want mine." Chapter 71. I finally dragged myself back to my apartment at sometime after 2 in the morning. The events of the long, horrible day, Jill losing her child, Claire's terrifying ordeal, flipped by like some old-time nightmare film sequence. The man I was tracking had almost killed my best friend. Why Claire? What could it mean? Part of me felt responsible, dirtied by the crime. My body ached. I wanted to sleep. I needed to wash away the day. Suddenly, the door to the guest bedroom opened, and my father shuffled out. In the madness of the day, I had almost forgotten he was here. He was wearing a long white T-shirt and boxers with a seashell pattern. Somehow, with the deprivation of sleep, I found this funny. You're wearing boxers, Boxer, I said. You're a witty old bastard. Then I told him what had happened. As a former cop, he would understand. Surprisingly, my father was a good listener. Just what I needed right about then. He came around to my side of the couch. You want coffee? I'll go make it, Lindsay. Brandy would do the trick better, but there's some Moonlight Sonata tea on the counter there if you're up to it. It was nice to have someone here, and he seemed eager to calm me. I sank back in the couch, shut my eyes, and tried to figure out what I was going to do next. Davidson, Mercer, and now Claire Washburn. Why would Chimera come after Claire? What did it mean? My father came back with a cup of tea and a snifter of Courvoisier, 2 inches full. I figure you're a big girl, so why not both? I took a sip of tea, then drank about half the brandy in a gulp. Oh, I needed that. Almost as much as I need a break on this case. He's leaving clues, but I still don't get it. Take it easy on yourself, Lindsay, my father said in the gentlest voice. What do you do, I asked, when everyone in the world is watching and you have no idea what to do next? When you realize that whatever you're fighting isn't giving in, that you're fighting a monster. That's about where we're usually called in homicide, my father said with a smile. Don't try to make me laugh, I begged. But my father had me smiling in spite of everything. Even more surprising to me, I was starting to think of him as my father. His tone suddenly changed. I can tell you what I did when it really got tough. I took off. You won't do that, Lindsay, I can tell. He's so much better than me. He was looking squarely at me, no longer smiling. What happened next, I would never have believed. My father's arms just sort of parted, and almost without resistance, I found myself burrowing into his shoulder. He wrapped his arms around me, a little tentatively at first. Then, just like any father and any daughter, he squeezed me with tender care. I didn't resist. I could smell the same cologne he wore when I was a child. It felt both strange and, at the same time, like the most natural thing in the world. Having my father hold me unexpectedly, it felt like layers of pain were suddenly stripped away. You're going to catch him, Lindsay, I heard him whisper, squeezing me and rocking. You will, Buttercup. It was just what I needed to hear. Oh, Daddy, I said. Nothing more, though. Chapter 72. Lieutenant Boxer, Brenda buzzed me early Monday. Warden Estes from Pelican Bay, Line 2. I picked up the phone, not expecting much. You asked if we ever had a policeman imprisoned here, Estes said. I perked up immediately. And? Mind you, I don't give a shit about some lunatic ravings from Weiss, but I did go back through the old files. There was a case here that might have some relevance. 12 years ago. I was warden at Soledad when this scum arrived here. I took the phone off speaker, pressing the receiver to my ear. They had him here for 5 years, two of them in ISO. Then they shipped him back to Quentin. A special case. You may even remember the name. I picked up a pen and started racking my brain. A cop at Pelican? Quentin? Frank Coombs, Estes said. I did recognize the name. It was like a headline flashing back from my youth. Coombs. A street cop. He had killed a kid in the project some 20 years before. Got run up on charges, sent away. To any San Francisco cop, his name was like a warning bell for the use of excessive force. Coombs turned into more of a bastard in prison than he was on the outside, Estes went on. He choked a cellmate Blue down in Quentin, which is why they shipped him here. After a stay in the SHUs, they were able to cure him of some of his antisocial tendencies. Coombs. I wrote down the name. I couldn't remember anything about the case except that he had choked and killed this black kid. What makes you think this Coombs might fit? I asked. As I said, Estes cleared his throat, I don't much care about Weiss's ravings. What made me call was that I asked some of our staff. When he was here, Coombs was a charter member of that little group of yours. My group? That's right, Lieutenant. Chimera. Chapter 73. You know the saying, when one door slams in your face, another one opens. Half an hour later, I rapped on my window for Jacoby. What do you know about Frank Coombs? I asked when he came into my office. Warren shrugged. Dirtbag street cop, got some teenager in a stranglehold during a drug bust years ago. The kid died. Major departmental scandal when I was in uniform. Didn't he get a dime up in Quentin? 20. I slid Coombs's personal file toward him. Now tell me something I can't find in here. Warren opened the file. As I remember, the guy was a tough cop, decorated. But at the same time, I figure this file's got enough OCC reprimands for excessive force to rival Rodney King. I nodded. Keep going. You read the file, Lindsay? He busted up a basketball game in one of the projects, thought he recognized one of the players as some kid he put away for drugs but was spit back out. The kid said something to him, then he took off. Coombs went after him. We're talking about a black kid, I injected. They gave him 15 to 20, second-degree manslaughter. Jacoby blinked. Where are we going with this, Lindsay? Weiss, Warren. At Pelican Bay? I thought he was just ranting, but something he said stuck. Weiss said he'd given me something. He said it sounded like an inside job. You dredged up this old file because Weiss said it was an inside job? Jacoby screwed his brow. Coombs was Chimera, I said. He spent 2 years in the SHUs. Take a look. The guy had SWAT training. He was qualified for marksman status. He was an avowed racist. And he's out. Coombs was released from San Quentin a few months ago. Jacoby sat there stone-faced. You're still short of motive, Lieutenant. I mean, granted, the guy was a major asshole, but he was a cop. What would he have against other cops? He pleaded self-defense, that the kid was resisting. No one backed him, Warren. Not his partner, not the other officers on the scene, not the brass. You think I'm reaching? I grabbed the file, skimmed through, and stopped where I had circled something in red marker. You said Coombs killed this kid in the projects? Jacoby nodded. I pushed the page at him. Bayview, Warren. LaSalle Heights. That's where he choked that kid. Those projects were torn down and rebuilt in 1990. They were renamed Whitney Young, Jacoby said. Near where Tasha Catchings had been killed. Chapter 74. My next move was to dial up Madeline Akers, assistant warden at San Quentin Prison. Maddie was a friend. She told me what she knew about Coombs. Bad cop, bad guy, real bad inmate. A cold son of a bitch. Maddie said she would ask around about him. Maybe Frank Coombs had told somebody what he planned to do once he got outside. Madeline, this absolutely can't leak out, I insisted. Mercer was a friend, Lindsay. I'll do anything I can. Give me a couple of days. Make it one, Maddie. This is vital. He is going to kill again. For a long time, I sat at my desk trying to piece together just what I had. I couldn't place Coombs at a crime scene. I had no weapon. I didn't even know where he was. But for the first time since Tasha Catchings was killed, I had the feeling I was on to something good. My instinct was to ask Cindy to troll through the Chronicle's morgue for old stories. These events had happened more than 20 years before. Only a few people in the department were still around from those days. Then I remembered I had someone who'd been there staying under my own roof. I found my father watching the evening news when I walked through the door. Hey, he called. You're home at a decent hour. Solve your case. I changed my clothes, grabbed a beer from the fridge. Then I pulled up a chair across from him. I need to talk to you about something. I looked in his eyes. You remember a guy named Frank Coombs? My father nodded. There's a name I haven't heard in a long time. Sure, I remember him. Cop who choked the kid over in the projects. They brought him up on murder charges, sent him away. You were on the force, right? Yes, and I knew him. Worst excuse for a cop I ever ran into. Some people were impressed with him. He made arrests, got things done, in his own way. It was different then. We didn't have review committees looking over our shoulder. Not everything we did got into the press. This kid, he choked, Dad. He was 14. Why do you want to know about Coombs? He's in jail. Not any longer. He's out. I pulled my chair closer. I read that Coombs claimed he killed the kid in self-defense. What cop wouldn't? He said the kid tried to cut him with a sharp object he took to be a knife. You remember who he was partnered up with back then, Dad? Jesus, my father shrugged. Stan Dragula, as I recall. Yeah, he testified at the trial. But I think he died a few years back. No one wanted to work with Coombs. You were scared to walk through the neighborhoods with him. Was Stan Dragula white or black? I asked. Stan was white, my father answered. I think Italian or maybe Jewish. That wasn't the answer I had been expecting. No one had backed Coombs up. But why was he killing blacks? Dad, if it is Coombs doing these things, if he is out for some kind of revenge, why against blacks? Coombs was an animal, but he was also a cop. Things were different then, that famous blue wall of silence. Every cop is taught at the academy, keep your yap shut. It'll be there for you. Well, it didn't hold up for Frank Coombs. It came tumbling down on him. Everyone was glad to give him up. We're talking, what, 20 years ago? The affirmative action thing on the force was strong. Blacks and Latinos were just starting to get placed in key positions. There was this black lobby group, the OFJ. Officers for Justice, I said. They're still around. My father nodded. Tensions were strong. The OFJ threatened to strike. Eventually, there was pressure from the city, too. Whatever it was, Coombs felt he was handed over, hung out to dry. It started coming clear to me. Coombs felt he had been railroaded by the black lobby of the department. He had chewed on his hatred in prison. Now, 20 years later, he was back on the streets of San Francisco. Maybe another time this kind of thing might have been swept under the rug, I said. But not then. The OFJ nailed him. Suddenly, a sickening realization wormed into my brain. Earl Mercer was involved, wasn't he? My father nodded his head. Mercer was Coombs's lieutenant. Part 3, The Blue Wall of Silence. Chapter 75. The next morning, the case against Frank Coombs, which only a day ago had seemed flimsy, was bursting at the seams. I was pumped. First thing, Jacoby rapped at my door. One for your side, Lieutenant. Coombs is looking better and better. How so? You make any progress with Coombs's P.O.? You might say. He's gone, Lindsay. According to the P.O., Coombs split from this transient hotel down on Eddy. No forwarding address. Hasn't checked in. Hasn't contacted his ex-wife. I was disappointed that Coombs was missing, but it was also a good sign. I told Jacoby to keep looking. A few minutes later, Madeline Akers called from San Quentin. I think I've got what you want, she announced. I couldn't believe she was responding so soon. Over the past year, Coombs was paired with four different cellmates. Two of them have been paroled, but I spoke with the other two myself. One of them told me to stuff it. But the other, this guy Torricetti, I almost didn't even have to tell him what I was looking for. He said the minute he heard on the news about Davidson and Mercer, he knew it was Coombs. Coombs told him he was going to blow the whole thing wide open again. I thanked Maddie profusely. Tasha, Mercer, Davidson, it was starting to fit together. But how did Estelle Chipman fit in? A force took hold of me. I went outside and dug through the case files. It had been weeks since I'd looked at them. I found it buried at the bottom. The personnel file I'd called up from records. Edward C. Chipman. In his 30 unremarkable years on the force, only one thing stood out. He had been his district's representative to the OFJ. The Officers for Justice. It was time to put this on the record. I buzzed Chief Trocchio. His secretary, Helen, who had been Mercer's, said he was in a closed-door meeting. I told her I was coming up. I grabbed the Coombs file and headed up the stairs to 5. I had to share this. I barreled into the chief's office. Then I stopped, speechless. To my shock, seated around the conference table were Trocchio, Special Agents Ruddy and Hull of the FBI, the press flak Carr, and Chief of Detectives Ryan. I hadn't been invited to the latest task force meeting. Chapter 76. This is bullshit, I said. It's total crap. What is this, some kind of men's club? Trocchio, Ruddy and Hull from the FBI, Carr, Ryan, 5 boys seated around the table, minus me, the woman. The acting chief stood up. His face was red. Lindsay, we were about to call you up. I knew what this meant. What was going on? Trocchio was going to shift control on the case. My case. He and Ryan were going to hand it over to the FBI. We're at a critical moment in this case, Trocchio said. You're damn right, I cut him off. I swept my gaze over the group. I know who it is. Suddenly, all eyes turned my way. The boys were silent. It was as if the lights had been cranked up and my skin prickled as if it had been cauterized. I leveled my eyes back on Trocchio. You want me to lay it out for you, or do you want me to leave? Seemingly dumbfounded, he pulled out a chair for me. I didn't sit. I stood. Then I took them through everything, and I enjoyed it. How I had been skeptical at first, but then it began to fit. Chimera, Pelican Bay, Coombs's grudge against the police force. At the sound of Coombs's name, the departmental people's eyes grew wide. I linked the victims, Coombs's qualification as a marksman, how only a marksman could have made those shots. When I finished, there was silence again. They just stared. I wanted to pump my arm in victory. Agent Ruddy cleared his throat. So far, I haven't heard a thing that links Coombs directly to any of the crime scenes. Give me another day or two, and you will, I said. Coombs is the killer. Hull, Ruddy's broad-shouldered partner, shrugged optimistically toward the chief. You want us to follow this up? I couldn't believe it. This was my case. My breakthrough. Homicides. Our people had been murdered. Trocchio seemed to mull it over. He pursed his thick lips as if he were sucking a last drop through a straw. Then he shook his head at the FBI man. That won't be necessary, Special Agent. This has always been a city case. We'll see it through with city personnel. Chapter 77. Only one thing was standing in the way now. We had to find Frank Coombs. Coombs's prison file mentioned a wife, Ingrid, who had divorced him while he was in prison and remarried. It was a long shot. The PO said he hadn't been in touch, but long shots were coming in right now. Come on, Warren, I nudged Jacoby. You're coming with me. It'll be like old times. Aw, ain't that sweet. Ingrid Thiessen lived on a pleasant middle-class street off Laguna. We parked across the street, went up, and rang the bell. No one answered. We didn't know if Coombs's wife worked, and there was no car in the driveway. Just as we were about to head back, an old model Volvo station wagon pulled into the driveway. Ingrid Thiessen looked about 50, with stringy brown hair. She wore a plain, shapeless blue dress under a heavy gray sweater. She climbed out of the car and opened the rear hatch to unload groceries. An old cop's wife. She ID'd us the minute we walked up. "What do you people want with me?" she asked. "A few minutes. We're trying to locate your ex-husband." "You got nerve coming around here," she scowled, hoisting two bags in her arms. "We're just checking all the possibilities," Jacoby said. She snapped back, "Like I told his parole officer, I haven't heard a word from him since he got out." "He hasn't been to see you?" "Once, when he got out, he came by to pick up some personal stuff he thought I had held for him. I told him I threw it all out."
"What kind of stuff?" I asked.
"Useless letters, newspaper articles on the trial, probably the old guns he kept around. Frank was always into guns. Stuff only a man with nothing to show for his life would find value in."
Jacoby nodded. "So what did he do then?"
"What did he do?" Ingrid Thiessen snorted. "He left without a word about what life had been like for us for the past 20 years, without a word about me or his son. You believe that?"
"And you have no idea where we could contact him?"
"None. That man was poison. I found someone who's treated me with respect, who's been a father to my boy. I don't want to see Frank Coombs again."
I asked, "You have any idea if he might be in touch with your son?"
"No way. I always kept them apart. My son doesn't have any links to his father, and don't go buzzing around him. He's in college at Stanford."
I stepped forward. "Anyone who might know where he is, Miss Thiessen, it would be a help to us. This is a murder case." I saw the slightest sign of hesitation.
"I've lived a good life for 20 years. We're a family now. I don't want anyone knowing this came from me."
I nodded. I felt the blood rushing to my head.
Frank kept up with Tom Keating, even when he was locked away. Anyone knows where he is, it'd be him.
Tom Keating. I knew the name. He was a retired cop. Chapter 78. Less than an hour later, Jacoby and I pulled up in front of Condo 3A at the Blakesley Residential Community, down the coast in Half Moon Bay. Keating's name had stuck in my mind from when I was a kid. He'd been a regular at the Alibi after the 9-to-4 shift, where many afternoons I'd been hoisted up on a bar stool by my father. In my mind, Keating had a ruddy complexion and a shock of prematurely white hair. God, I thought, that was almost 30 years ago. We knocked on the door of Keating's modest, slatted wood condo. A trim, pleasant-looking woman with gray hair answered. "Mrs. Keating, I'm Lieutenant Lindsay Boxer of the San Francisco Homicide Detail. This is Inspector Jacoby. Is your husband at home?"
"Homicide?" she said, surprised.
"Just an old case," I said with a smile. A voice called from inside.
"Helen, I can't find the damned clicker anywhere."
"Just a minute, Tom. He's in the back," she said as she motioned us into the house.
We walked through the sparsely decorated house and into a sunroom overlooking a small patio. There were several framed police photos on the wall. Keating was as I remembered him, just 30 years older. Gaunt, white hair thinning, but with that same ruddy complexion. He sat watching an afternoon news show with the stock market tape streaming by. I realized he was sitting in a wheelchair. Helen Keating introduced us, then, finding the clicker, put the TV volume down. Keating seemed pleased to have visitors from the force.
"I don't get to many functions since my legs went. Arthritis, they tell me. Brought on by a bullet to lumbar 4. Can't play golf anymore," he chuckled. "But I can still watch the old pension grow."
I saw him studying my face.
"You're Marty Boxer's little girl, aren't you?"
I smiled. "The alibi.
A couple of 501s, right, Tom? A 501 was the call for backup, and how they used to call a favorite drink, an Irish whiskey with a beer chaser.
I heard you were quite the big shot these days, Keating nodded with a toothy smile. So what brings you two honchos down to talk to an old street cop?
Frank Coombs, I said. Keating's features suddenly turned hard.
What about Frank?
We're trying to find him, Tom. I was told you might know where he is.
Why don't you call his parole officer? That wouldn't be me.
He's split, Tom. 4 weeks now. Quit his job.
So they got homicide following up on parole offenders now?
I held Keating's eyes. What do you say, Tom?
What makes you think I'd have any idea?
He glanced toward his legs.
Old times are old times.
I heard you guys kept in touch. It's important.
Well, you're wasting your time here, Lieutenant, he said, suddenly turning formal.
I knew he was lying. When was the last time you spoke with Coombs?
Maybe just after he got out. Could be once or twice since then. He needed some help to get on his feet. I may have lent him a hand.
And where was he staying? Jacoby cut in.
While you were lending him this hand.
Keating shook his head.
Some hotel down on Eddy or O'Farrell. Wasn't the St. Francis, he said.
And you haven't spoken with him since? My eyes flicked toward Helen Keating.
What do you want with the man anyway? Keating snapped. He's paid his time. Why don't you just leave him alone?
It would be easier this way, Tom, I said, if you'd just talk to us. Keating pursed his dry lips, trying to size up where his loyalties fell.
You put in 30 years, didn't you? Jacoby said.
24, he patted his leg. Got it cut short at the end.
24 good years. It'd be a shame to dishonor it in any way by not cooperating now.
He shot back.
You want to know who was a goddamn expert in lack of cooperation? Frank Coombs. Man was only doing his job, and all those bastards, supposedly his friends, looked the other way. Maybe that's the way you do things now, with your community action meetings and your sensitivity training. But then, we had to get the bad guys off the streets, with the means that we had.
Tom, his wife raised her voice, Frank Coombs killed a boy. These people, they're your friends. They want to speak with him. I don't know how far you have to take this duty and loyalty thing. Your duty's here.
Keating glared at her harshly. Yeah, sure, my duty's here.
He picked up the TV clicker and turned back to me.
Stay here all day if you like. I don't have the slightest idea where Frank Coombs is.
He turned up the volume on his TV. Chapter 79.
Fuck him, Jacoby said as we left the house, old school asshole.
We're halfway down the peninsula already, I said to him. You want to drive to Stanford, see Frankie's kid?
What the hell, he shrugged. I can use the education.
We hooked back onto 280 and made it to Palo Alto in half an hour. As we pulled onto the campus drive, the tall palms lining the road, the stately ochre buildings with their red roofs, the Hoover Tower majestically rising over the main quad, I felt the spell of being part of campus life. Every one of these kids was special and talented. I even felt some pride that Coombs's son, despite his rough beginnings, had made it here. We checked in at the administrative office on the main quad. A dean's assistant told us that Rusty Coombs was probably at football practice down at the field house. Said Rusty was a good student and a great tight end. We drove there, where a student manager in a red Stanford cap took us upstairs and asked us to wait outside the weight room. Moments later, a solidly built, orange-haired kid in a sweaty Cardinals t-shirt wandered out. Rusty Coombs had an affable face spotted with a few freckles. He had none of the dark, brooding belligerence I had seen in photos of his father.
I guess I know why you guys are here, he said, coming up to us. My mom called, told me.
The heavy sound of weight irons and lifting machines clanged in the background. I smiled affably.
We're looking for your father, Rusty. We were wondering if you have any idea where he might be.
He's not my father, the boy said and shook his head. My father's name is Theodore Bell. He's the one who brought me up with Mom. Teddy taught me how to catch a football. He's the one who told me I could make it to Stanford.
When was the last time you heard from Frank Coombs?
What's he done, anyway? My mother said you guys are from Homicide. We know what's in the news. Everyone knows what's going on up there. Whatever he did before, he paid his time, didn't he? You can't believe just because he made some mistakes 20 years ago, he's responsible for these terrible crimes.
We wouldn't have driven all the way down unless it was important, Jacoby said.
The football player shifted back and forth on the balls of his feet. He seemed to be a likable kid, cooperative. He rubbed his hands together. He came here once. When he first got out, I had written him a couple of times in jail. I met with him in town. I didn't want anybody to see him.
What did he say to you? I asked.
I think all he wanted was to clear his own conscience and know what my mother thought of him. Never once did he say, "Hey, great job, Rusty, look at you, you did good," or, "Hey, I follow your games." He was more interested in knowing if my mom had thrown out some of his old things.
What sort of things? I asked. What would be so important that he would drive all the way here and confront his son?
Police things, Rusty Coombs said and shook his head. Maybe his guns.
I smiled sympathetically. I knew what it was like to look at your father with something less than admiration.
He give you any idea where he might go?
Rusty Coombs shook his head. He looked like he might tear up.
I'm not Frank Coombs, inspectors. I may have his name. I may even have to live with what he did. But I'm not him. Please leave our family alone. Please.
Chapter 80. Well, that sucked. Stirring up bad memories for Rusty Coombs made me feel terrible. Even Jacoby agreed. We made it back to the office about 4. We'd driven all the way down to Palo Alto just to run into another dead end. What fun. There was a phone message waiting for me. I called Cindy back immediately.
There's a rumor floating around that you've narrowed on a suspect, she said.
Truth or dare?
We have a name, Cindy, but I can't tell you anything. We just want to bring him in for questioning.
So there's no warrant?
Cindy, not just yet.
I'm not talking about a story, Lindsay. He went after our friend, remember? If I can help.
I got 100 cops working on it, Cindy. Some of us have even handled an investigation or two before. Please, trust me.
But if you haven't brought him in, then you haven't found him, right?
Or maybe we haven't made the case yet. And Cindy, that's not for print.
This is me talking, Linz. Claire, too, and Jill. We're in this case, Lindsay. All of us.
She was right. Unlike any other homicide case I had worked, this one seemed to be growing more and more personal.
Why was that?
I didn't have Coombs, and I could use the help. As long as he stayed free, anything could happen.
I do need your help.
Go through your old files, Cindy. You just didn't go back far enough.
She paused, then sucked in a breath.
You were right, weren't you? The guy's a cop.
You can't go with that, sweetie. And if you did, you'd be wrong. But it's damned close.
I felt her analyzing, and also biting her tongue.
We're still going to meet, aren't we?
I smiled.
Yeah, we're going to meet. We're a team, more than ever.
I was about to pack it in for the night when a call buzzed through to my line. I was sitting around thinking that Tom Keating had been lying, that he'd spoken to Coombs. But until we put out a warrant, Keating could hold back all he wanted. To my utter surprise, it was his wife on the line. I almost dropped the phone.
My husband's a stubborn man, Lieutenant, she began, clearly nervous. But he wore the uniform with pride. I've never asked him to account for anything, and I won't start now. But I can't sit back. Frank Coombs killed that boy.
and if he's done something else, I refuse to wake up every morning for the rest of my life knowing I abetted a murderer.
It would be better for everybody, Mrs. Keating, if your husband told us what he knows.
I don't know what he knows, she said, and I believe him when he says he hasn't spoken to Coombs in some time. But he wasn't telling the whole truth, Lieutenant.
Then why don't you start? She hesitated.
Coombs did come by here. Once. Maybe 2 months ago.
So you know where he is? My blood started to rush.
No, she answered. But I did take a message from him, for Tom. I still have the number.
I fumbled for a pen. She read me the number, 434-9117.
I'm pretty sure it was some kind of boarding house or hotel.
Thank you, Helen. I was about to hang up when she said, There's one more thing. When my husband said he lent Coombs a hand, he wasn't telling the whole story. Tom did give him some money, but he also let him rummage through some old things in our storage locker.
What sort of things? I asked. His old department things. Maybe an old uniform and a badge?
That's what Coombs had been looking for in his ex-wife's house. His old police uniforms. My mind clicked. Maybe that's how he got so close to Chipman and Mercer.
That's all? I asked.
No, Helen Keating said. Tom kept guns down there. Coombs took those, too.
Chapter 81. Within minutes, I traced the number Helen Keating had given me to a boarding house on Larkin and McAllister, the Hotel William Simon. My pulse was jumping. I called Jacoby, catching him as he was about to sit down to dinner. Meet me at Larkin and McAllister, the Hotel William Simon.
You want me to meet you at a hotel? Cool, I'm on my way.
I think we found Coombs, I said. We couldn't arrest Frank Coombs. We didn't have a single piece of evidence that could tie him directly to a crime. I might be able to get a search warrant and bust into his room, though. Right now, the most important thing was to make certain he was still there. 20 minutes later, I had driven down to the seedy area between the Civic Center and Union Square. The William Simon was a shabby one-elevator dive under a large billboard with a slinky model wearing Calvin Klein underwear. As Jill would say, yick. I didn't want to go up to the desk, flashing my badge and his photo, until we were ready to make a move. Finally, I said, what the hell, and placed a call to the number Helen Keating had given me. After 3 rings, a male voice answered, William Simon? Frank Coombs? I inquired. Coombs. I listened as the desk clerk leafed through a list of names. Nope. Shit. I asked him to double check. He came back negative. Just then, the passenger door of my Explorer opened. My nerves were twanging like a bass guitar. Jacoby climbed in. He was wearing a striped golf shirt and some sort of short, hideous, members-only jacket. His belly bulged. He grinned like a John.
Hey, lady, what does an Andrew Jackson get me?
Dinner, maybe, if you're treating.
We got an ID? He asked.
I shook my head. I told him what I had found out.
Maybe he's moved on, Jacoby offered. How about I go in and flash the badge with Coombs's photo?
I shook my head. How about we sit here and wait? We waited for over 2 hours. Stakeouts are incredibly dull. They would drive the average person nuts. We kept our eyes peeled on the William Simon, going over everything from Helen Keating to what Jacoby's wife was serving for dinner to the 49ers to who was sleeping with who at the hall. Jacoby even sprung for a couple of sandwiches from a Subway. At 10 o'clock, Jacoby grumbled,
This could go on forever. Why don't you let me go inside, Lindsay?
He was probably right. We didn't even know if Helen Keating's number was current. She had taken it weeks ago. I was about to give in when a man turned the corner on Larkin headed towards the hotel. I gripped Jacoby's arm. Look over there. It was Coombs.
Coombs. I recognized the bastard instantly. He was wearing a camouflage jacket, hands stuffed in his pockets, a floppy hat pulled over his eyes. "Son of a fucking bitch," Jacoby muttered. Watching the bastard slink up to the hotel, it took everything I had not to jump out of the car and slam him up against a wall. I wished I could slap him in cuffs. But we had Chimera now. We knew where he was. "I want someone stuck to him 24 hours," I told Jacoby. "If he makes the tail, I want him picked up. We'll figure out the charges later." Jacoby nodded. "I hope you brought a toothbrush," I winked. "You've got first watch." Chapter 82. As they walked hand in hand toward her Castro apartment, Cindy admitted to herself that she was scared shitless. This was the fifth time she and Aaron Winslow had been out together. They had seen Cyrus Chestnut and Freddie Hubbard at the Blue Door, been to Traviata at the opera, taken the ferry across the bay to a tiny Jamaican cafe that Aaron knew. Tonight, they had seen this dreamy film, Chocolat. No matter where this went tonight, she enjoyed being with him. He was deeper than most men she'd dated, and he was definitely more sensitive. Not only did he read unexpected books, like Dave Eggers' A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius and Amy Tan's The Bonesetter's Daughter, he lived the life that he preached. He worked 12 to 16-hour days and was loved in his neighborhood, but he still managed to keep his ego in check. She'd heard it over and over again, interviewing people for her story. Aaron Winslow was one of the good guys. All the while, though, Cindy had felt this moment looming in the distance, hurtling closer and closer, ticking. This was the natural step, she told herself. As Lindsay would say, their foxhole was about to explode. "You seem a little quiet tonight," Aaron said. "You okay, Cindy?" "I'm great," she fibbed. She thought he was just about the sweetest man she had ever gone out with. But, Jesus, Cindy, he's a pastor. Why didn't you think of this then? Is this a good idea? Think it through. Don't hurt him. Don't get hurt yourself. They stopped walking in front of the entrance to Cindy's building and stood in the lighted arch. He sung a line from an old R&B tune. "I've passed this way before." He even had a good singing voice. There was no use postponing it any longer. "Look, Aaron, someone has to say this. You want to come up? I'd like it if you did. Hate it if you didn't." He exhaled and smiled. "I don't exactly know where to take this, Cindy. I'm a little out of my range. I've never dated a blonde before. I wasn't expecting any of this."
"I can relate to that," she smiled. "But it's only two floors up. We can talk about it there."
His lip was quivering slightly, and when he touched her arm, it sent a shiver down her spine. God, she did like him, and she trusted him. "I feel like I'm about to cross this line," he said. "And it's not a line I can cross casually, so I have to know. Are we there together, in the same place?" Cindy elevated on her toes and pressed her lips lightly against his mouth. Aaron seemed surprised, and at first he stiffened. But slowly, he placed his arms around her and gave himself over to the kiss. It was just as she had hoped, that first real kiss, tender and breathtaking. Through his jacket, she could feel the rhythm of his heart pounding. She liked it that he was afraid, too. It made her feel even closer to him. When they parted, she looked in his eyes and said, "We're there. We're in the same place." She took out her key and led him up the two floors to her place. Her heart was pounding. "It's great," he said. "I'm not just saying that." A two-story wall of bookshelves and an informal open kitchen. "It's you. Cindy, it seems silly that I haven't been up here before." "It wasn't for lack of trying," Cindy grinned. God, she was so nervous. He took hold of her again.
this time giving her a longer kiss. He certainly knew how to kiss. Every cell in her body felt alive. The small hairs on her arm, the warmth in her thighs. She pressed herself against him. She wanted, needed, to be close to him now. His body was slender, but he was definitely strong. Cindy started to smile.
So what were you waiting for?
I don't know. Maybe some kind of sign? She pressed herself into the grooves of his body, felt him come alive.
There's a sign, she said, close to his face.
I guess my secret's out now.
Yes, I do like you, Cindy.
Suddenly the phone rang, almost blasting in their ears.
Oh, God, she groaned. Go away, leave us alone.
I hope that's not another sign, he laughed.
Each ring seemed more annoying than the last. Mercifully, the answering machine finally kicked on.
Cindy, it's Lindsay, the voice shot. I've got something important. Please, pick up.
Go ahead, Aaron said.
Now that you're finally up here, don't use the time I'm on the phone to change your mind.
She reached behind the couch, fumbled for the receiver, put it to her ear.
I wouldn't do this for anyone but you, she said.
Funny, that's just what I was about to say.
Listen to this. Lindsay shared her news, and Cindy felt a rush of triumph surge through her. This was what she had wanted. It had been her angle that put Lindsay on to him. Yes.
Mañana, she said, and thanks for the phone call.
She placed the receiver down, squeezed back with Aaron, and looked into his eyes.
You wanted a sign? I think I've got the best one in the world.
A glimmer lit her face. They found him, Aaron.
Chapter 83. We kept watch all night at the William Simon, unofficially. So far, Coombs hadn't come out again. I knew where he was. Now all I had to do was make the case. That was the morning Jill came back to work. I headed to her office to bring her up to date. Coming off the elevator on the 8th floor, I ran into Claire, who must have had the same idea.
Great minds and all that, she said.
I've got big news, I told her, beaming with anticipation. Come on. We knocked on her door and found Jill at her desk, looking a little piqued. Stacks of documents and legal files gave us the impression she hadn't missed a single day. At the sight of us, her blue eyes sprang alive. But as she stood, her arms outstretched for a hug, Jilly seemed to be moving at half her usual speed.
Don't, I said as I went over and gave her a hug. You've got to take it easy.
I'm fine, she answered quickly. Abdomen's a little stiff, heart's a little broken, but I'm here, and this is the best thing for me.
You sure this is the smartest thing? Claire asked her.
It is for me, Jill shot back. I promise, Doc, I'm fine. So please, don't start trying to convince me otherwise. You want to help me start to heal? Just bring me up to date on what's going on. We looked at her a little skeptically, but then I had to share the news. I think we found him.
Who?
Jill asked. I beamed. Chimera. Claire gave me a stare. She closed her eyes for a moment as if in prayer, then opened them with a sigh. Jill looked impressed.
Jesus, you son of a bitches have been busy while I've been away.
They asked all the right questions, and I laid it all out for them. When I told them the name, Jill muttered,
Coombs, I remember the case from law school.
A spark lit in her eyes.
Frank Coombs, he killed a teenage boy.
You're sure it's him? Claire asked. She was still wearing a bandage on her neck.
I hope so, I said.
Then, without any doubt, yes, I'm sure it's him.
You arrest him yet? Claire asked. Can I visit him in his cell? I got this bull bat I've been meaning to try out.
Not yet. He's holed up at some dive in the Tenderloin. We've got him under 24-hour watch. I turned to Jill.
What do you say, counselor? I want to bring him in.
She came over, a little gingerly, and leaned on the corner of her desk.
Okay,
Tell me exactly what you have.
I went through each link. The loose connections to three of the victims, Coombs's history as a marksman, his documented grudge against blacks, how the OFJ had sealed his fate. But with each strand of evidence, I saw her conviction dim. Jill, listen, I held up my hand. He took a department-issued 38 from a retired cop, and Mercer was killed with a 38. Three of the targets tied directly to his own history. I've got a guy in San Quentin who says he boasted he was out for revenge. 38s are a dime a dozen, Lindsay. Do you have a match on the gun? No, but Jill, Tasha Catching's murder took place in the same neighborhood where Coombs went down 20 years before. She cut me off. What about a witness who can place him at the scene? One witness, Lindsay. I shook my head. A print, then, or a piece of clothing? Something that ties him to one of the murders. With an exasperated breath, I reacted. No. Circumstantial evidence can convict, Jill, Claire cut in. Coombs is a monster. We can't just let him stay out on the streets. Jill looked sharply at both of us. Geez, she was almost the Jill of old. You don't think I want him as much as you? You don't think I look at you, Claire, and think just how close we came? But there's no weapon, barely a motive. You haven't even placed him within sight of a murder scene. If you bust in and don't find anything, you've lost him for good. Coombs is Chimera, Jill, I said. I know I don't have it buttoned up yet, but I've got a motive and links that tie him to three victims, as well as outside testimony that corroborates his intentions. Jailhouse testimony, said Jill. Juries laugh at it these days. She got up, came over, and put a hand on both Claire's and mine. Look, I know how badly you want to close this. I'm your friend, but I'm still the law. Bring me anything. Someone who saw him at a scene, a print he left on a door. Give me anything, Lindsay, and I'll be bashing down his door to get at him the same as you. Turn him upside down, rattle him until his spare change falls out. I stood there, teeming with frustration and anger, but knowing that Jill was right. I shook my head and made my way toward the door. What are you going to do? Asked Claire. Rattle the fucker. Turn his life upside down. Chapter 84. 15 minutes later, Jacoby and I picked up Cappy outside the William Simon and headed into the rundown lobby of the hotel. A sleepy-eyed Sikh was leafing through a newspaper in his native tongue behind the front desk. Jacoby thrust Coombs's photo and his badge in front of the man's startled eyes. What room? It took about 3 seconds for the turbaned clerk to squint at the photo, flip through a bound black register, and in a tight accent say, 307, he is registered with the name Burns. He pointed, elevator to the right. Moments later, we stood in the dingy, paint-chipped hallway on the third floor outside Coombs's room, flicking our automatics off safety. Remember, we're only talking, I cautioned. Keep your eyes open for anything we can use. Jacoby and Cappy nodded, then each took a position on either side of the door. Cappy knocked. No one answered. He knocked again. Mr. Frank Burns? Finally, a heavy, grumbling voice.
Go the fuck away. Get lost, huh? I'm paid up through Friday.
Jacoby shouted. San Francisco Police, Mr. Burns. We got you your morning coffee. There was a long pause. I heard some commotion, the sound of a chair being dragged and a drawer closed. Finally, the sound of footsteps coming closer and a voice barking.
What the fuck do you want?
Just to ask you a few questions. You mind opening the door? It took about a minute of waiting with our fingers tensed on the triggers for the door to finally unlatch. It swung open, revealing an angry Coombs. Chimera. His face was round and heavy, with eyes that sagged into deep-set craters. Short, graying hair, a large, flat nose,
mottled skin. He had on a white short-sleeved undershirt, pulled over rumpled gray trousers, and his eyes burned with hatred and disdain.
"Here," exclaimed Jacoby, swatting him in the chest with a rolled-up Chronicle. "Your morning paper. Mind if we come in?"
"Yeah, I mind."
Coombs scowled. Cappy smiled. "Anyone ever tell you you're a dead ringer for this cat who used to be on the force? What the hell was the cat's name? Oh, yeah, Coombs. Frank Coombs. You ever hear that from anybody before?" Coombs blinked impassively. Then his mouth curled into a half smile.
"Wouldn't you know, I get boarded on planes for him all the time."
If he recognized Jacoby or Cappy from years ago on the force, he didn't register it. But he squinted a look of familiarity as his gaze fell on me.
"Don't tell me after all this time you bozos are the department's welcome home committee."
"How about you just let us in?" Jacoby asked.
"You come with a warrant?"
Coombs leered. "I told you nicely. We're just delivering your morning paper."
"Then make a fucking scene. Come on,"
Coombs said between gritted teeth. His eyes were something else. They burned a hole right into the back of your skull. Cappy pressed the door firmly in Coombs's face. Then he and Jacoby pushed their way into the room. "As long as we're here, we might as well run a couple of questions by you." Coombs rubbed his unshaven chin, glaring vicious darts at us. He finally pulled out a wooden chair from a small table and took a seat, with his arms wrapped around its back.
"Fuckers! Useless shitbirds!"
The tiny room was littered with newspapers, Budweiser bottles lined up on the sill, cigarette butts in Coke cans. I had the sense that if I could only poke around, something was there. "This is Lieutenant Boxer of the homicide detail," Jacoby said. "We're Inspectors Jacoby and McNeil."
"Congratulations. I feel safer already. What do you three stooges want?"
"Like I said," Jacoby replied, "you should read the papers. Keep abreast of what's going on. You follow what's in the news much?"
"You got something to say? Say it."
"Why don't you start by telling us where you were 4 nights ago, I started in. Friday, around 11 o'clock.
"Why don't you kiss my ass? You want to play games? Let's play. I was either at the ballet or the opening of that new art exhibition. I can't recall. My schedule is too full these days."
"Simplify it for us," Cappy said.
"Sure, yeah. Actually, I was with friends."
"These friends," Jacoby cut in. "They have names, phone numbers. I'm sure they'd be happy to vouch for you."
"Why?"
Coombs's mouth puckered into a slight grin.
"You got someone who says I was somewhere else?"
"I guess what I was thinking," I met his eyes, "was when was the last time you made it out to Bayview? Your old stomping grounds. Maybe I should say your choking grounds." Coombs glared. I could tell he wanted to wrap his hands around my neck. "So he does read the papers," Cappy chortled. The ex-con continued to glare.
"What the fuck, Inspector? You think I'm some rookie whose knees start to shake when you wag your dick at him? Sure, I read the papers. You assholes can't solve your case, so you come up here and you shake my bush for old time's sake. You got zip on me. Otherwise, you wouldn't be lap dancing in my face, and we'd be having this talk down at the hall. You think I killed all those dingo bastards and locked me up? Otherwise, oh, look at the time. My town car's waiting. Are we done?"
I wanted to take him by the throat and smack his smug face against the wall, but Coombs was right. We couldn't take him in. Not with what we had. "There are a few questions you're going to have to answer, Mr. Coombs. You'll have to answer why 3 people are dead who had a connection to your murder charge 20 years ago. You'll have to answer what you were doing on the nights they were killed." The veins on Coombs's forehead started to bulge. Then he calmed and curled his lips into a smile.
"You must be up here, Lieutenant, because you've got some eyewitness that can place me at one of the murder scenes."
I stared at his face without answering.
"Or my prints all over some weapon or fibers from this rug, right? Or my clothing? You just came up here to let me turn myself in with dignity?"
I stood there, inches from Chimera, watching his arrogant grin.
You think just because you affirmative action flunkies come up here and look tough at me, I'm going to shove up my ass and say, hey, stick it here. Gives me a real kick seeing those assholes drop one by one. You took my life away. You want to make me sweat, Lieutenant? Then pretend you're real cops. Find something that will stick.
I stood there, staring into those cold, haughty eyes. I wanted to take him down so bad. I was tempted. Consider yourself a murder suspect, Mr. Coombs. You know the routine. Don't leave town. We'll be back to see you soon. I nodded at Cappy and Jacoby. We moved toward the door. One more thing. I turned back with a grin of my own. Just so you know, from Claire Washburn, lean a little to the left, huh? Asshole.
Chapter 85.
I was totally wired after work. There was just no way I could go home and unwind. I headed down Brannan toward Potrero, my mind replaying the gut-stabbing interview with Coombs. He was taunting us, laughing in our faces, knowing we couldn't bring him in. I knew who Chimera was, but I couldn't touch him. I stopped at a light, not wanting to go home, but not knowing where else to go. Cindy had a date. Jill and Claire were home with their husbands. I probably could have had a date if I made myself the least bit available. I thought about calling Claire, but my cell phone was down. I needed to recharge the damn battery. I wanted to do something. The urgency was ripping through me. If only I could get in Coombs's hotel room. I felt torn between heading home and possibly making the biggest mistake of my career. My rational voice said, Lindsay, go home. Get him tomorrow. He's going to mess up soon. The pounding in my heart said, baby. Stay on him. Rattle the fucker. I swung my Explorer onto 7th and headed for the Tenderloin District. It was almost 9 o'clock. My car seemed to drive itself to the William Simon. My chest felt tight and pressurized. Pete Worth and Ted Morelli had night watch, and as I pulled up, I spotted them in a blue Acura. They had orders, if Coombs left, to follow and radio in. Earlier that day, Coombs had sauntered out, strolled conspicuously around the block, and finally settled in a coffee shop to read the paper. He knew he was being watched. I climbed out of my Explorer and went over to Worth and Morelli. Any sign? Morelli leaned out the driver's side window. Nada, Lieutenant. He's probably up there watching the Kings game, the scumbag. He knows we're stuck down here. Why don't you go home? We got him covered for the night. Much as I hated to admit it, he was probably right. There was nothing much I could do here. I started the engine again and flashed a wave to the boys as I passed by. But at the corner, on Eddy, some controlling impulse restrained me from leaving. It was as if something were saying, what you want is here. He knows he's being watched, and he wants to show up the SFPD. I drove down Polk, back toward the William Simon. I passed pawn shops, an all-night liquor store, a storefront Chinese takeout. A parked patrol car sat at the end of the block. I drove past the rear of the hotel. Several garbage cans outside, not much else. The street was deserted. I turned off my lights and sat there. I don't know what I was expecting to happen, but I was driving myself crazy. I finally climbed out of the Explorer and went inside the back door of the hotel. Rattle the fucker. I was thinking about going back upstairs to talk to Coombs again. Yeah, maybe we could watch the Kings game together. There was a narrow, dingy bar just off the lobby. I took a peek inside. Saw a couple of real skulls, but not Frank Coombs. God damn it. A murderer was here in this hotel, a cop murderer, and we couldn't do a thing about it. A movement near the back stairs caught my eye. I ducked back inside the shadowy bar. A real oldie was playing on the juke, Sam and Dave's Soul Man. I watched a person coming down the stairs, casting glances around like the fugitive. What the hell was this? I recognized the camouflage jacket. The floppy hat pulled over his face. I stared hard to be sure. It was Frank Coombs. Chimera was on the move.
Chapter 86. Coombs ducked into the kitchen of a greasy spoon attached to the hotel. I waited a few seconds, then I followed him. Now I was the one keeping my head down, casting furtive looks. I saw Coombs, but he'd changed. He'd put on a white kitchen jacket and a greasy chef's hat. I remembered my cell phone, and then that it was dead. I wasn't on duty. I hadn't really needed it. Coombs walked right out the back door of the hotel. Before I had a chance to signal the patrol car discreetly, he ducked into an alleyway. I looked down the alley and saw that it angled toward the street where I was parked. I ran for my car. Thank God I could still see him. Coombs hurried across the street, not 20 feet in front of my car. I hoped I'd have a chance to signal the patrol car, but I didn't. Coombs ducked into an empty lot, heading toward Van Ness. I was angry at our people. They had let him out. They had blown it. I waited until he disappeared into the lot. Then I spun the Explorer around and headed toward the intersection. At the light, I made a right, throwing on the car lights. The busy street was crowded. A Kinko's, a Circuit City, people passing by. I watched where I thought the empty lot might come out. I sat there, scanning up and down the block. Could he have beaten me out here? Could he have slipped into the crowd? Shit! Suddenly, up ahead, I spotted the camouflage jacket slinking out of an alley between the Kinko's and a Favor shoe store. He had dumped the cook's jacket and hat. I was pretty sure he hadn't seen me. He looked around in both directions, then, hands in pockets, started south toward Market. I wanted to run him down with my car. At the next intersection, I spun the Explorer around and headed back on the other side of the street, about 20 yards behind Coombs. He was pretty good at this. He moved well. Obviously, he was in shape. Finally, he seemed satisfied that he'd made a clean escape. He nearly had. At Market Street, Coombs jogged into the middle of the street at a BART station. He hopped an electric bus heading south. I followed as the bus continued south on Mission. Each time it stopped, I slowed on the brakes, craning to see if Coombs had jumped off. He never did. He was taking it out of the city center. Out near Bernal Heights, at the Glen Park station, the bus hung at the stop for a few seconds. Just as it was starting up again, Coombs hopped off. It was too late for me to stop. I had no choice but to pass right by. I hunched low, every nerve of my body on edge. I'd been on lots of stakeouts, tailed dozens of cars, but never with so much at risk. Coombs hung on the platform, scanning in both directions. I had no choice but to continue on. In the rearview mirror, I watched him. He seemed to be following my car as it faded out of sight. Damn! All I could do was drive. I was incredibly angry, so pissed. When I was sure I was out of sight, I accelerated, climbing a residential hill, cutting a 3-point U-turn out of a driveway, and prayed Coombs would still be there. I sped across the street and spun around to the Glen Park station from the other side. The son of a bitch was gone. I frantically scanned every direction, but there was no sign of him. I pounded the wheel in anger. Fucker! I yelled. Then, about 30 yards ahead, I spotted a mustard-colored Pontiac Bonneville pulling out of a side street, then stopping at the side of the road. The only reason I fixed on it was that it was the only thing moving. Suddenly, there was Coombs. He ducked out of a storefront and jumped into the Bonneville's passenger side door. Back at ya, I said to myself. Then the Bonneville sped away. So did I.